The appellant may save time for rebuttal. Everyone, please double-check your cell phones and make sure they're turned off. We'll now hear argument.
May it please the court, Cynthia Harvey, 38511, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Dennis Barnum. With the court's permission, I would like to begin with issue four and work backwards.
Go ahead.
Mr. Barnum was tried and convicted by a jury, and his habitual trial to the court began following. The trial court committed reversible error when it heard the evidence presented by the state, found that evidence to be insufficient, and instead of continuing the case, dismissed those four habitual counts. After the court dismissed the counts, the state requested rehearing. The court granted the rehearing, reversed its decision, and when it commenced with the second trial on the habitual counts, placed Mr. Barnum in jeopardy twice for the same criminal acts.
And when did the court first hear evidence of the habitual charges?
I believe that was on May 18th.
But when in the course of the proceedings?
Right after the...
After it reinstated the charge, or...
No, prior to that. Initially, the court heard the counts as the state was going to present them. They were not specific in the dates. The state went through each charge and gave a date range. The court didn't believe that that was sufficient. The state was prepared and had marked those documents to be admitted. However, the court
at that time, had any testimony been taken?
No testimony had been taken other than the state's presenting of its case.
So
they had not yet called a witness.
Thank you.
However, under Colorado case law dating back to Markowitz case, jeopardy attaches when the evidence is presented. And as recently as 2007, where I believe it was a division of this court, heard the Valencia case, the Markowitz holding was incorporated in that opinion as one of the times where jeopardy can attach when the evidence is presented. So when the trial is to a court, jeopardy attaches either when the evidence is presented or the first witness is sworn. Regardless of this issue, the Quintana case, which holds that jeopardy attaches when the jury is sworn, still remains, and it is Mr. Barnum's position that that would apply. However, if this court were to decide that because this was a trial to a court, they don't wish to apply Quintana, although Mr. Barnum disagrees, he would submit that under existing case law regarding trials to the court, it attaches also when the evidence is presented. And in this case, that occurred on May 18th, 2001.
Well, counsel, pardon me for interrupting, but what evidence was presented? There were no exhibits?
The exhibits were proffered. However, when they were proffered, the trial court told the state that if they would go forward with submitting them formally, then they would be in violation of double jeopardy. So the state had gone through the information in all of the exhibits and discussed the case with the judge. The judge made a decision, rightly or wrongly, that the case was going to be insufficient. And when the state went to admit the documents formally, the judge stopped the proceedings, told her she would violate double jeopardy if she did so, and ended the proceedings what the court should have and could have done would have been to grant a request for a continuance. In that case, they would not have been violating double jeopardy. They could have come back with corrected information or asked him to reconsider at a later date, and we wouldn't be here today arguing that issue.
Isn't that in effect what happened? Wasn't it really a continuance because the charges were reinstated and the trial picked up right where it had left off? Isn't that correct?
It could have been a continuance, but it was not. He clearly dismissed. The difference is the ruling by the court that these charges are dismissed.
Well, but the court didn't start the trial all over again, the proceeding all over again. It picked up right pretty much where it left off, didn't it?
There were two proceedings after. The court had a proceeding where he heard the motions and the argument about why the counts should be reinstated and heard the jeopardy argument. After that proceeding, or at the conclusion, he issued a ruling that his dismissal was incorrect, that the charges were sufficient, and that they would go forward.
Okay, but I'm talking about that last proceeding you just talked about when the court ruled that the proceedings would go forward. Didn't it pretty much take up where it had left off? It didn't require new opening statements and new proffers and that sort of stuff, did it?
I believe that it did start at the beginning again on the third proceeding where they called the witnesses. It did start at the beginning as far as my recollection of what the transcripts show. But I will rely on the transcripts.
Ms. Harvey, is there a difference between the substantive, I'll call it the substantive trial, and the habitual criminal proceedings that follow once the defendant has been convicted?
I believe that the legislature determined that there is some difference, which would be why they went from a jury trial to a court trial. However, what is unchanged is that the state has the burden beyond a reasonable doubt to prove the prior convictions. And the risk of failing to prove them is clearly on the state as opposed to on the defendant. And the case law interpreting these rights has always come down on the side of granting to the defendant every constitutional protection that they would have in a trial of the substantive charge. So while they are proving different items, that's different. But the constitutional rights afforded to the defendant remain basically the same. And in Mr. Barnum's case, at the point where the court decided that he was unhappy with the case that the state was presenting, he could have.
But however, the case was not that the people were not presenting a case at that time, or they had presented no evidence.
It is Mr. Barnum's position, and I believe the transcripts will reflect that they were discussing in detail the charges as the state was offering them, and that the judge felt that that was insufficient to go forward.
However, they had not called a witness nor introduced an exhibit into evidence.
They had not called a witness nor introduced an exhibit, but based on a reading of Valencia and Markowitz, that doesn't matter. As it stands today, they had begun presenting evidence. And what the state should have done would be to ask for a continuance. They didn't. And because of the protections that every defendant should be afforded, Mr. Barnum's convictions on the habitual counts should be reversed and should be remanded for sentencing without the habitual enhancements. To add further to the issues with the habitual counts is the decision by the trial court not to allow Mr. Barnum to attack his prior convictions. There was significant and long-standing evidence presented in the record of various mental illness diagnoses by Mr. Barnum, spanning over a 30-year time period, including schizophrenia, organic brain damage, an IQ of 67, which placed him in the mentally retarded range. And to top that all off, significant substance abuse issues, which have been chronic and long-term. The record reflects that the psychologist who examined Mr. Barnum, Dr. Dick, had done extensive testing, had done IQ testing, and had presented this information at the competency hearing, at the hearing on whether or not there was justifiable excuse. However, the court erred when they accepted competency ruling as the law of the case for the justifiable excuse issue. In addition, the trial court disregarded all of the evidence presented that supported and showed the diagnoses that Mr. Barnum suffered from, including schizophrenia. There were discussions of specific testing, specific answers that had been done, and the record is replete with examples of mental illness, which is debilitating and significant. According to Wiedemer, the overriding concern is a due process concern for the defendant, and that the protection be that a defendant be allowed due process to challenge prior convictions. And the factor of circumstances or influences preventing a challenge was clearly established by Mr. Barnum through the testimony of his psychologist, as well as the documents showing his previous mental illness issues.
So are you asking that we find as a matter of law that those particular mental health issues constitute justifiable excuse, or are you asking us to conclude that the court abused its discretion when it found that there was no, that these matters did not constitute justifiable excuse?
The combination of these mental illnesses and diseases should be justifiable excuse. However, at a minimum, in this case, specific to Mr. Barnum and the combination of this 30-year period, should be that the court did, in fact, abuse its discretion in its findings.
Thank you.
And if there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
You may. You have, as you can see, 2 minutes, 2¾ minutes.
May it please the court, John First for the people. Under 18.1.301D, jeopardy attaches in a bench trial when the first witness is sworn. That clearly didn't happen here. It's a gloss, judicial gloss, and I think that it comes out of Valencia, that finds jeopardy attached when evidence is admitted, an exhibit is admitted. That didn't even happen here.
Mr. First, would there be a circumstance under which there would be no witnesses called, only documents presented, and the court makes its findings and verdict based on documents only?
Of course, but they would have to, the court would have to admit them. They have to be authenticated. We have to go through all the rules of evidence that permit that to be admitted. So of course, in a habitual trial, of course, we need testimony for identification purposes.
Or if they're stipulated in.
Well, that's possible, but this court, that might be a different situation. If everything was stipulated in, that would certainly be closer. But of course, that didn't happen here.
And of course, then the evidence would have been admitted rather than simply presented prior to admission proffered. Should there be any distinction between that? Should we really make a distinction? Assuming for a minute that we consider the Valencia approach and it's a question of evidence as opposed to testimony, should there be a distinction as to whether the evidence was admitted or whether the evidence was merely presented?
I, I think so, because I think you have to go back to the statute itself, and the statute is when a witness is sworn, there's a formality there, and I think that the analogous situation with documentary evidence or something other than live testimony would be when it is admitted. So yes, I think so. I think that the statute has to, as much as possible, be the guide here. And of course, and again, the statute's silent as to exhibits. So
why would it make a difference as to admission of the exhibits as opposed to the presentation of the exhibits?
Well, again, it's the formality of with a witness. A witness is, is sworn. He gets up there, and it's a formality. And it's not just a formality. And we don't know what the evidence is until the court has found it's been authenticated, and it's in the rules of evidence permit the court to consider it. Prior to that, there's nothing really for the court to consider.
No,
so I think it does make a difference.
Okay, and later in this case, after the charges were reinstated, there was a witness who testified to provide a foundation for the documents,
yes.
Was there not?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
And briefly to address, so defense makes the claim here and in the brief that jeopardy attached when the jury was sworn in the guilt phase. And I took a look at Quintana, and Quintana, of course, at that time, it was a bifurcated proceeding, jury hearing both phases, and the court there found that jeopardy had attached when the jury was sworn in the guilt phase, because it was the same jury as one continuous proceeding. Clearly, we didn't have that here. I mean, it was close to a year and a half between the verdicts and when the habitual phase commenced. I'm not sure if there's any real precedent. I mean, Valencia seemed to, the division in Valencia just seemed to assume, I'm not sure, I don't think the issue was raised there, but they assumed that jeopardy attached when the exhibit evidence was admitted there. But I think clearly Quintana's distinguishable in that regard, in that there you had one continuous proceeding between guilt and penalty phases. Unless the court has other questions on the double jeopardy issue, I'll move to the justifiable excuse, excusable neglect. I think what this court needs to keep in mind I think what the court needs to keep in mind is that when the defendant raises asserts mental issues as the excuse for an untimely collateral attack, that this mental inability has to be in existence for the entire period from the inception of the conviction, when it's finally when it's final, and when the filing of the motion. And in that regard, defendant didn't testify. So it ended up the battle of the experts, and it's an issue of fact for the court to decide, trial court to decide in the first instance, whether a defendant established a justifiable excuse, excusable neglect, and that's his burden. And the court was free to accept, to credit the prosecution's expert and to not credit the defendant's expert, which it did here. The record supports it, and the only way defendant prevails here on appeal is if this court finds he can establish that its trial court's findings were clearly erroneous. And there's plenty of support in the record for the court's finding that according to the prosecution's expert was cocaine dependent, an alcohol abuser, a malingerer. Prosecution's expert did not diagnose mental retardation. did not diagnose a psychotic disorder, and in fact testified there was no reason why the defendant would have been unable or mentally incapable to take steps to get out of prison. That was in the record, and the court was entitled to rely on that. And even the defendant's expert made some concessions that significantly undermine his position. Defendant's expert conceded that there was no way to assess the difference between the defendant's present and prior mental states, even conceded that the defendant's responses to a prior advisement about the waiver of rights in one of the prior convictions demonstrated an understanding of what the court was explaining. So it's the record's replete with support for the trial court's determination in this regard.
Mr. First,
yes, sir.
I didn't get to ask Ms. Harvey about this. I think Ms. Harvey said that she contends that the court erred by accepting competency testimony or competency testing as the basis for its justifiable excusable neglect ruling. The testimony that you just referred to by the people's expert, was that specifically with regard to the justifiable excusable neglect issue?
Yes, Your Honor, it was at that hearing. So I was a little unclear when the counsel argued that they accepted the competency findings. I'm not sure about that. I know that both Dr. Jennings and Dr. Dickey testified in regard to this, and citations are in my brief. And of course, I'm not sure that the court couldn't, but the court didn't rely solely on that. Unless the court has any other questions, I just ask that you affirm the conviction.
Mr. First, would you address the 404B issue?
Sure.
The people chose to argue this as not falling within 404B. As I see it, you've argued it as res gestae.
Alternatively, Your Honor.
What's that?
Alternatively.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not. I would also, we also defended in my brief. I defended the court's 404B ruling as well.
Would you address the question under 404B?
Of course. It's clear that it related to the proper purpose of establishing the defendant's identity. I mean, that was clearly at issue on both sides. It was the defendant's theory of the case that he had been misidentified.
Does Garner require that the court make findings regarding this SPOTO criteria?
I'm not sure Garner requires specific findings in all areas. I mean, we can make some inferences here, and I think we can infer
I'm just asking with regard to the court's findings as opposed to this court. We can't make any inferences. We can't make findings.
That's correct. That's true.
We could, I guess, arguably infer that the court made. Considered the SPOTO issues and resolved them against the defendant, but we don't have findings on the record, or do we?
Well, I think we have enough on the record. My notes indicate that I brought with me here that the court ruled that the 404B, the Lewis incident, was similar to the charged incidents, and that's the fact that it was similar. I mean, is necessary to find identity, because you need an element, a significant degree of similarity to establish identity with regard to another act. So I think the court. I think that's. That in itself is sufficient. The court made.
Wouldn't that just be the third SPOTO prong? That is, that the evidence is probative, independent of and intervening conclusion regarding character.
I agree, but I think you can fold all the first three requirements into that. I mean, it has to be logically relevant for a proper purpose. And the fact that it's similar is a proper, you know, it indicates some logical relevance. And I mean, that's typically the way that
backtrack.
Garner does not say that there has to be specific rulings on every point as long as the ruling, you know.
Okay.
Clearly doesn't say that.
And with regard to similarity, I mean, as I'm understanding your argument, the similarity goes to modus operandi, and modus operandi goes to identity.
Correct.
And MO requires a high degree of similarity. What were the specifics in this case of the similarity, besides the fact that the defendant was in a house that, or excuse me, allegedly was in a house that he was not supposed to be in? What other similarities were there?
Well, I think similarity and number of instances, and I think that's important. One-on-one, the similarities were not as great as in other situations, but at the time the court ruled, this was one of four burglaries that occurred that day. It wasn't until shortly before trial that the court dismissed two of the counts. And I think at that point it was, and things changed. I mean, the calculus was different at that point. Clearly, we had gone from four burglaries on that April 19th down to two.
One of which was charged and one of which was uncharged.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And the two others that had been initially charged were no longer before the jury, were no longer being litigated. And I think at that point it was incumbent upon the defendant to ask the court to revisit the situation. I mean, I think as it probably affected probative value as much as, I mean, clearly that made it a little, you know, somewhat less probative at that point. Still, though, I mean, you had the burglary that was still remained on that day, and the other act were geographically 4 miles apart. They were straight up Peoria. I mean, if you look at a map, there even there, you know, there's some degree of possibly enough similarity. But then I go back to the fact that this court doesn't need to go there, can find that any error, even if it was error, was harmless because the prosecution argued it. If I may finish,
go ahead.
Thank you. The prosecution argued the similar only with respect to the other burglary that occurred that day, the Wilcox burglary, and the jury acquitted on that. So clearly the jury wasn't overmastered by the admission of that evidence.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to just briefly address the 404B issues as well.
Before you start there and basic to that issue, I note in your brief that you talk about the people raising the issue through a notice of intent and the court ruling on the issue, but you never indicate whether or not the defendant actually preserved this issue for appeal. In fact, you go on to say that defense moved to exclude Mrs. Lewis's testimony based upon a failure to disclose exculpatory evidence of two alternate suspects. Is this issue properly before us?
Yes, it is.
Why?
The defense objected to the ruling by the court, and raising it pre-trial, which is the preferred method, is sufficient to preserve this issue for appeal.
Is that
further?
Is that contained in your brief somewhere?
That it is.
That the defendant raised that issue pre-trial. All I see is that the people filed a notice of intent to use 404B evidence. I don't see anything about defendant objecting to it.
It is in I believe it's in my reply brief, that a hearing was held on that issue and that the defendant lost, basically, in the pretrial hearing opposing the use of this evidence.
Is it raised for the first time in your reply brief, then?
I would have to check the opening, but I wrote the reply and responded to the answer.
Ms. Harvey, let me just interrupt you so you can go on.
Yes.
Under Rule 28K, you're required to tell us whether, in your opening brief, whether the issue was preserved or not preserved, where it was preserved in the record, and what the standard of review is. And part of this problem is that the opening brief doesn't do that.
Okay.
Proceed.
If it's not in there, then it's not in there. Whether or not the act of being in Ms. Lewis's kitchen was similar to the burglaries that were occurring in this county on that during that time period, I don't believe the record supports. The officer himself testified that at the time there were hundreds of burglaries occurring, different times of day, different witness or different descriptions of the person involved, different methods and modems of entry. I see that I'm almost
go
out
ahead
of...
continue. We took up some of your time on
okay
the question.
Thank you. So as far as this being similar and the photo analysis being conducted, it was not, and it is not similar enough to meet the criteria and the standard. And briefly, the competency issue is in response to one of the things that counsel was referencing here, the generalities used by Dr. Dick in his testimony during the Gene hearing. What happened throughout that hearing and what the record will show is that the trial court continued to tell counsel that the law of the case was that Mr. Barnum was competent and that they weren't going to go there. So, in fact, Dr. Dick had specific instances and specific information, but that wasn't explored in the trial due to the trial court's rulings.
Thank you very much, Ms. Harvey.
And I would just like to respectfully request that this court reverse the convictions and remand back to the trial court for sentencing without the habitual counts.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. The case now stands submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.